Here it is!
From deep inside your radio.
Ladies and gentlemen, let's get right down to it. There are moments when you just got to say something. Social convention be darned. For example, let's say you're interviewing the President of the United States. Now, willy-nilly, he or she, thank you very much, is deserving of a modicum of respect because, as I say, willy-nilly, the President is not only the head of government, the person who climbed to the top of the greasiest pole in American society, but is also the head of state, the figure in whom is embodied the notion of nationhood. It's just that way because we made the mistake of getting rid of the monarch. You know, a meaningless person to whom we attach that kind of awe. So, okay, arguably, the President of the United States is owed at least that modicum of respect. Still, there are times when you just got to say something when you're interviewing the President of the United States. Case in point, this week, Charlie Rose on PBS, interviewing President Obama, talking about the assurances the President was giving that the scandal that has erupted around the reports of NSA surveillance of our phone calls and internet traffic, the reassurance is that there's nothing to worry about. And then Charlie asks this.
Should this be transparent in some way?
It is transparent. That's why we set up the FISA court.
He sounds impatient, and the only real rational response should have been, with all due respect, Mr. President, are you kidding? Case in point, from today's Washington Post, the public is getting a peek into the little-known workings of a powerful and mostly invisible government entity, the court whose secret rulings have in effect created a body of law separate from the one on the books, one that gives U.S. spy agencies the authority to collect bulk information about Americans' medical care, firearms purchases, credit card usage, and other interactions with business and commerce. The government can get virtually anything, says Senator Ron Wyden, Democrat of Oregon. He's a member of the Senate Intelligence Committee, so he's allowed to read many of the court's rulings, which are classified.
It is transparent. That's why we set up the FISA court.
Members of Congress from both parties are pursuing legislation to force the court's orders into the open. Critics say the court has undergone a disturbing shift created in 1978 to handle routine surveillance warrants, individualized, personalized warrants. Critics say it is now issuing complex, classified, Supreme Court-style rulings that are quietly expanding the government's reach into the private lives of Americans. Judges on this court are selected from the pool of sitting federal judges by the Chief Justice. That's required by the law that established the secret court. President doesn't nominate them. There is no additional confirmation process. The surveillance court is a different world of secret case law, non-adversarial proceedings, and rulings written by individual judges who rarely meet as a panel. They generally confer only with government lawyers and out of public view.
It is transparent. That's why we set up the FISA court.
Yet the judges have the power to interpret the Constitution and set long-lasting and far-reaching precedents on matters involving Americans' rights to privacy and due process under the Fourth Amendment. This fast-growing body of law is almost entirely out of view of legal scholars and the public. Most Americans do not have access to the court's full interpretation of the Constitution on matters of surveillance, search, and seizure when it comes to snooping for terrorist plots and are limited in their ability to challenge it. All 11 of the current members were appointed by Chief Justice John Roberts, 10 originally appointed to the federal bench by Republican presidents. The court's under-the-radar approach proved a particular challenge this spring to the Electronic Frontier Foundation when it sought to file a motion seeking release of the prior finding of the unlawful government surveillance that was under the Bush administration. It turned out the mere act of finding the court proved a steep hurdle. Repeated calls to the court clerk from the foundation went unreturned, says an attorney for the group, which wound up submitting the motion through a staff member at the Justice Department whose officials were actively opposing the group's efforts. Quote, "We never had any direct contact with the court," said the attorney for the foundation, and the other party in the proceeding was the gatekeeper.
It is transparent. That's why we set up the FISA court.
Mr. President, no due respect. Are you kidding? Hello, welcome to the show.
Funky. We'll be right back.
Sounds pretty good from London, where we see the sun maybe 45 seconds a day. I'm Harry Shearer, welcoming you to this edition of the show. And yes, there are more Are You Kidding moments in this week's presidential interview. Here's one right now. The president speaking to Charlie Rose again about positive steps that he's taken to avert Americans' suspicions that we are being spied on unnecessarily or improperly or even, pardon the expression, illegally.
I've stood up a privacy and civil liberties oversight board made up of independent citizens, including some fierce civil libertarians. I'll be meeting with them.
Well, in the meantime, let's take a look at that board. Let's look at some news from outside the bubble. From the newspaper that seems to be taking the lead on all aspects of this surveillance story, The Guardian in London. More about that board the president said he was standing up. The body charged by President Obama with protecting the civil liberties and privacy of the American people exists in shadows almost as dark as the intelligence agencies it's designed to oversee. The Privacy and Civil Liberties Board, the PCLOB, was due to meet Obama at the White House on Friday afternoon to discuss growing concerns over U.S. surveillance. Or at least that's what unnamed senior administration officials said would happen. The meeting did not appear on the president's official diary issued to journalists, his schedule, nor has the PCLOB issued much public confirmation beyond saying further questions were warranted. That might be because the PCLOB does not have a website, nor an email address, nor indeed any independent full-time staff. Its day-to-day administration is currently run by a government official sent over from the office of the Director of National Intelligence. That's right, the D-9. In fact, even the official address, the office address given out by the PCLOB in the few public letters that exist, does not appear to be functioning. A security guard of the federal building on 2100 K Street in Washington said he had no record of the mystery body that supposedly occupies Suite 500. It was set up as an agency within the executive office of the president in 2004. So it was stood up by President Bush. The PCLOB, for many years after it was set up, had no members at all. After the criticism in a congressional report that it, quote, appeared to be a presidential appendage devoid of the capability to exercise independent judgment, unquote, it was reconstituted as an independent agency in August 2007 under President Bush. Even then, oversight moved at a glacial pace. Obama nominated two members in January 2011 and a further three last December, but Senate only confirmed four of them last August. The fifth, Chairman David Medin, was confirmed just last month. Fierce civil libertarians, there's little in the published biographies to elaborate on that. Medin is a partner in a D.C. law firm, Wilmer Hale, and previously served as a senior advisor to the White House National Economic Council. Worked on the Federal Trade Commission and the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau and the Securities and Exchange Commission. The White House says he's long been interested in internet privacy and data security. Three of the others meeting Obama as members of the board have worked for the government or courts. Only Jim Dempsey of the Center for Democracy and Technology does not appear to have been a government employee or served on the judiciary. Following a meeting with intelligence chiefs last Wednesday, Medin, chairman of the Privacy Board, said, based on what we've learned so far, further questions are warranted. Unquote. Wow, that's fierce. But wait, there's more news from outside the bubble. And more bubblicious music to go with it. The Guardian, again, on this surveillance story, new details. apparently from Edward Snowden, the source for much of this information so far, who, as of today, is out of Hong Kong and apparently, according to the latest reports, as of the recording of this broadcast, on his way to Moscow. Anyway, here we go. Britain's spy agency, GCHQ, has secretly gained access to the network of cables which carry the world's phone calls and internet traffic. It has started to process vast streams of sensitive personal information, which it's sharing with its American partner, the NSA. One key innovation has been GCHQ's ability to tap into and store huge volumes of data drawn from fiber optic cables for up to 30 days. This operation, codenamed Tempora, sounds like a... Yes, I know what it sounds like. Has been running for some 18 months. This is all being carried out without any form of public acknowledgement or debate. GCHQ and the NSA are consequently able to access and process vast quantities of communications between entirely innocent people, as well as targeted suspects. Recordings of phone calls, content of email messages, entries on Facebook, and the history of any internet user's access to websites, all of which is deemed legal, even though the warrant system in England was supposed to limit interception to a specified range of targets. Sound familiar? The existence of the program has been disclosed in documents shown to The Guardian by the NSA whistleblower Edward Snowden. As part of his attempt to expose what he called the largest program of suspicionless surveillance in human history. It's not just a U.S. problem, Snowden told The Guardian. The GCHQ are worse than the U.S. By 2010, 2 years after the project was first set up, it was able to boast, was the GCHQ, that it had the biggest internet access of any member of the Five Eyes electronic eavesdropping alliance, composed of the United States, Britain, Canada, Australia, and New Zealand. British officials also claim GCHQ produces larger amounts of metadata than NSA. By May last year, 300 analysts from GCHQ and 250 from the NSA had been assigned to sift through the flood of data. The Americans were given guidelines for its use, but were told in legal briefings by GCHQ lawyers, we have a light oversight regime compared with the U.S. When it came to judging the necessity and proportionality of what they were allowed to look for, would-be American users were told that, quote, it was your call. The Guardian understands that a total of 850,000 NSA employees and U.S. private contractors with top-secret clearance had access to the GCHQ databases. But wait, there's more. The British Foreign Secretary William Hague was adamant when he addressed Parliament last week. He insisted the GCHQ agency operated within a strong framework of democratic accountability and oversight. The laws governing the intelligence agency provide the strongest system of checks and balances for secret intelligence anywhere in the world, he said. Not a light oversight regime, as The Guardian reported, GCHQ lawyers told the NSA. And leaked documents seen by The Guardian give the impression some high-ranking officials have that different view. Complaints against the spy agencies undertaken by the Interception Commissioner in Britain, are conducted under, quote, the veil of secrecy, unquote. And the Investigatory Powers Tribunal, which assesses complaints against the agencies, has, quote, so far always found in our favor, unquote, an intelligence official. By the way, that's almost as, that's, I guess, a better batting average than the FISA court has in this country. I think they've denied one application for a warrant.
That's why we set up the FISA court.
News from outside the bubble, ladies and gentlemen, a copyrighted feature of this broadcast. And now,
I guess I'm just lucky so-and-so.
This week's So's. So's your old man, by the way. Come courtesy of a listener. Thank you, listeners, for being so attuned to this. It comes from a listener who was listening to a broadcast on, what is it, NPR? Morning edition? Really? A discussion with NPR's social science correspondent. Of course, he put the so in social science during this particular interview, as you'll hear. So sit back, relax, and enjoy some really smart answers that begin with the word so, won't you?
What's the research about?
So anthropologists and writers and historians, Steve, have been exploring the idea of rituals for decades. They've just completed the first rigorous quantitative study on the effects that rituals have on eating.
Okay. What did they find?
So they ran a series of experiments.
Go on. Keep talking.
So they told the other volunteers to eat the candy bar exactly as they would like.
What about stuff that doesn't taste so good?
So they ran the same experiment with carrots.
So you say. The so's of the week, ladies and gentlemen. And now... news of the Olympic movement. Produced by Jim Ebersole Jr. A lot of Olympic news this week. Let's get to it. Russia's State Development Bank says it stands to lose billions of dollars from financing unprofitable construction projects for the 2014 Olympics in Sochi. Chairman Vladimir Dmitriev said in a recent interview with the Gazeta news portal in Russia that of the 19 projects the bank is funding, at least 8 would fail to turn a profit. Dmitriev expressed doubts the money will be repaid. The overall bill for the Winter Games in Russia stands at $51 billion, making them by far the most expensive Olympics in history. And regional authorities in Russia this week fired a prominent art museum director and opposition activist after he organized an exhibition poking fun at Russia's hosting of the 2014 Winter Olympics. Marat Gulman, an outspoken critic of President Putin, wrote on Twitter he'd been fired as head of the Museum of Contemporary Art in the city of Perm. It was a lovely Perm. A spokesman of the governor confirmed that the contract is torn up as of today. That's confirmed to TASS. Remember TASS? It was like Pravda. Last week, Perm authorities banned 3 exhibitions at the White Nights Festival, curated by Gulman. One show called Welcome Sochi 2014 included a picture of Stalin wearing the costume of an Olympic mascot and an image of the Olympic rings as hanging nooses. Perm Governor Viktor Basargin wrote on his blog that he categorically disliked the idea of this exhibition. The hosting of the Winter Olympics is supposedly a huge matter of national pride in Russia, even though the preparations have been mired by scandals about massive overspending and environmental damage. Gulman wrote on Twitter, the region's culture minister, Igor Gladnyev, just called and confirmed the fact I was fired. He obviously mixes up his job with the security services, said the bitter ex-director. The International Olympic Committee says it's fully supportive of peaceful protest in Brazil and is confident the 2016 Olympics in Rio de Janeiro will bring major benefits. That's a surprise. The IOC says the games will be good for you. Anti-government protests, as you probably know, have spread across Brazil in the past week. They're targeting the billions of dollars being spent to host the 2016 Summer Games as well as next year's World Cup. In a statement to the AP, the IOC said the 2016 Games will benefit, quote, the whole population of Rio. Back in Russia, the Russian authorities are investigating reports that an electrician working at a Sochi Winter Olympics site was tortured by police. Martiros Demarchin says he was detained and sexually assaulted with a crowbar after he complained to his foreman he'd been underpaid. His brother-in-law and fellow worker was also detained and beaten, but less seriously. I guess that means no crowbar. Russian police have frequently been accused of violence against detainees. Demirchin and his brother-in-law worked on a residential block for Olympic volunteers this spring. Each man had been promised about $2,750 for the work. They were given about a third of that. When they complained, they were first threatened, then called to a meeting with the foreman on June 12th. But police officers were there instead. They were taken to a police station, according to Demirchin's wife. In custody, they were allegedly told to confess in writing to stealing building materials. When he refused, he was beaten all night by 5 policemen, losing some of his teeth. He finally signed a blank piece of paper. So don't make fun and don't complain. The rules of the Olympics in Russia. The Olympics, it's a movement, and we all need one. Every day. Oh, and one more piece of Olympic news. An American design studio has claimed it came up with the idea for the Olympic cauldron made of metal petals and stems long before it became a centerpiece of last year's London Olympics. The design by Thomas Heatherwick won worldwide acclaim last year, but New York studio Utopia now claims it presented an almost identical design to the organizers of London Olympics Games in 2007. They claim to have had the idea of petals for each nation being carried by children into the stadium. It looked identical to something we'd proposed back in 2007, after which we hadn't heard anything, says Jane Harrison, a director of the New York studio. Utopia saw the design when the Olympics opened last summer, but said they were bound by confidentiality rules. On companies using the London Olympics to promote themselves. The confidentiality rules were lifted in January this year. Heatherwick Studio, when told of the similarity between the designs, says, "This has come completely out of the blue." The creative ideas for the cauldron were very much born from a conversation between Danny Boyle and Thomas Heatherwick, unquote. But the point of the story, ladies and gentlemen, it seems to me, is we just need, in contemporary life, we just need more confidentiality rules.
Okay.
This is Le Show from London, and now news of AFPAC, starting with Pakistan. We'll get to Afghanistan shortly. Don't you worry. 20 people, three of them security personnel, have been gunned down by suspected militants during the last 2 years for vaccinating children against polio in the area around Peshawar in Pakistan. Pakistan aid workers say their woes began, this is according to NBC, when it emerged that Dr. Shakil Afridi, a Pakistani physician, ran a fake vaccination campaign in Abbottabad to collect DNA samples from bin Laden and his family to prove his presence there to the CIA. There's outrage in Pakistan that Afridi helped that plot or that plan or that scheme. He's sentenced to 33 years imprisonment for treason on May of this year. He's appealing the verdict. But many Pakistan aid workers say they're paying the ultimate price for his actions ever since his role became public. Their job has become increasingly dangerous now. Most parts of the country have become no-go zones for aid workers trying to vaccinate against polio. Militants have tried to block the vaccination, saying they're part of a conspiracy to sterilize and reduce the world's Muslim population. Since then, UNICEF and the WHO have spent millions to create awareness campaigns. The strategy seems to have backfired as the number of parents refusing vaccines is on the rise. Pakistan's a key country in the battle to eradicate polio. Only three nations in the world, Afghanistan, Nigeria, and Pakistan, are still polio endemic. Thank you, CIA. And now over to Afghanistan, where the news this week was dominated by the decision of the Taliban, the announcement the Taliban is going to open an office in Doha for the purpose of beginning talks with the United States over the what's next in the Afghanistan war. There's some controversy over that because the United States says the Taliban is going to be talking to the Afghan government as well, and the Taliban says, no, they're not. They've also said it's a full service operation akin to an embassy as opposed to a squat just for talks, that they'll be issuing press statements and all sorts of embassy-like functions. The other big news out of there this week was that the official handover of the military operations in Afghanistan from NATO to the Afghan government was completed this week. From now on, our troops will only be there to, watch TV. And the Washington Post reports, facing that tight withdrawal deadline for all U.S. troops to be out of there and tough terrain, the U.S. military has destroyed more than 170 million pounds worth of vehicles and other military equipment as it rushes to get out of there. The massive disposal effort, which U.S. officials say is unprecedented, has unfolded largely out of sight. See? More confidentiality. There's an ongoing debate, though, inside the Pentagon about what to do with the heaps of equipment that won't be returning home. Military planners have determined they will not ship back more than $7 billion worth of equipment, about 20% of what we have there, because it's no longer needed or it would be too expensive to ship back home. The Pentagon says bequeathing a large share to the Afghan government would be challenging because of complicated rules governing equipment donations to other countries, and concerned that Afghanistan's fledgling forces, Washington Post's word, would be unable to maintain it. Some gear may be sold or donated to allied nations, but few are likely to be able to retrieve it because it's still in the war zone. Therefore, much of it will continue to be shredded, cut, and crushed to be sold for pennies per pound on the Afghan scrap market. The destruction of tons of equipment is all but certain to raise sharp questions in Afghanistan and the United States about whether the Pentagon's approach is fiscally responsible. You think? This is the, says Major General Kurt Stein, head of the 1st Sustainment Command. We're making history doing what we're doing here. This is the largest retrograde mission in history. Unquote. That's what it looks like from here. What does it look like from over there?
From Afghanistan Public Radio, your most trusted source of Afghanistani public radio.
Ugh, that doesn't sound right.
It's fine. From the newly encircled presidential palace in downtown Kabul, the city that never wakes up, I'm Mahmoud.
And I'm Hamid. We're Slick and Slack, the Autonomy Brothers. Welcome to another edition of Cars I Talk.
Today's program comes to you with the help of the Afghanistan National Army. National is our middle name.
Very consequential week around the palace, my brother.
Indeed. We got the first floor plumbing fixed. Now I can wear my good shoes to the show.
And as you can hear, many responsibilities here have been returned from our friends in NATO too, Afghan hands. Mm-hmm.
Including the engineering of this show.
If you can call it engineering.
Which reminds me, how many Afghan engineers does it take to screw in a light bulb?
I don't know how many.
What's a light bulb?
No, we kid the fine staff here at APR. Mm-hmm. They learned well from their NATO advisors.
Oh, before the advisors came here, we didn't even know where the tote bag was.
We thought the pledge week was when we took time off to clean the furniture.
What's furniture?
Hello, you're on Cars I Talk.
Hello, this is Kenneth, first-time caller, long-time NATO commander.
Oh, hello, sir. Are you calling on a cell phone?
No, I'm using my landline.
Well, that would be the problem.
I guess it was at our end.
That doesn't mean we can't blame it on him.
Well, you always did.
Well, you know what the poor farmer in Kandahar told me.
No, sir, what?
If it wasn't for scapegoats, I wouldn't have any goats at all.
General, yes, we have to defend what we can now, and one thing we can defend is our format. So, do you have a question for us?
Yes, I do. We do have a lot of radio equipment that we are disposing of post-handover, and we were wondering if...
If we wanted you to hand it over?
Indeed.
Actually, thanks to the success of our most recent fund drive, we have so much high-quality broadcast equipment around here that we're thinking of actually plugging it in.
As soon as we finish the next fund drive.
What's that for?
Some high-quality electricity.
Well, we do have some vehicular items that are now surplus.
Well, I'll ask for my brother. Anything in the way of an Italian sports convertible?
It can have bullet holes. I've got a wonderful body, man.
I'm afraid not, fellas. General Petraeus left word early on. The good cars go back with the officers. The scrappers get the Humvees.
Well, you know what we Afghans say. Better a scrapper than a rapper. Thanks for the call.
I'm still on the line. Oh. I had one more.
Hello, General. This is Mr. Salahuddin, long-time Taliban, first-time user of non-secure phone.
Well, hello. I was just getting off the radio with...
I know. I wanted to pass on a message to Mr. Karzai.
Well,
hello, caller. This is Hamid.
And I'm Mahmoud. We're Slick and Slack.
The General, will you please pass on the message to the President that we will not be speaking directly to him on this call?
I do think he can hear you.
I certainly can, although my brother was wearing these headphones on our last show and they still reek of his cologne.
General, we are looking forward to opening full operation of our Doha facility, and we would certainly like to bid on any equipment you no longer need. We could use, for example, those Humvees.
You know, this is kind of a delicate conversation to be having over the air, where anyone could be listening.
In fairness, anyone could be listening to a private conversation. It's just more likely somebody actually would.
Oh, you've seen our ratings.
General, I think you should tell our caller that this would pose a political problem for both NATO and for me, so it's probably not a...
I am authorized to say we will pay substantially over Blue Book.
Well, I should refer that back to headquarters. consideration, but I have to ask, how did you get my number in the first place?
I work part-time at the NSA.
Wow, good personal vetting.
I'm not talking to him.
He says he's not.
We know, we know. Thanks for the call.
We had help today from the Ford Prefect Foundation, supporting coverage of the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. Legal services for Cars I Talk from the law firm of Ketchum & Newcomb. I'm Hamid.
And I'm Mahmoud.
Join us again for another edition of Cars I Talk.
This is APR, Afghanistan Public Radio.
Sleepwalking in the light,
And now, ladies and gentlemen, the apologies of the week.
We're so sorry.
Well, Paula Deen, cooking maven on the Food Network, is so nice, she apologized twice. Story came out this week that she had mooted, as they say in Britain, a plan for a wedding dinner that would feature, you know, all black waiters and bow ties. Like, it would harken back to the plantation days. And it also came out in a deposition in a racial discrimination lawsuit brought against Deen by one of the people involved in the planning of that wedding, that Deen had uttered the N-word, had admitted that she'd uttered the N-word on many occasions way back when. So here was the first video apology issued by Paula Deen as a word of that deposition testimony came out this week.
I want to apologize to everybody for the wrong that I've done. I want to learn and grow from this. Inappropriate, hurtful language is totally, totally unacceptable. I've made plenty of mistakes along the way, but I beg you, my children, my team, my fans, my partners, I beg for your forgiveness. Please forgive me for the mistakes that I've made.
Then that video was taken down, apparently by Paula Deen or her people, and a little while later, another one went up.
So I'm taking this opportunity now that I've pulled myself together and am able to speak to offer an apology to those that I have hurt. I want people to understand that my family and I are not the kind of people that the press is wanting to say we are. I've spent the best of 24 years to help myself and others. Your color of your skin, your religion, your sexual preference does not matter to me, but it's what's in the heart, and my family and I try to live by that. And I am here to say I am so sorry. I was wrong. Yes, I've worked hard and I've made mistakes, but that is no excuse. And I offer my sincere apology to those that I have hurt, and I hope that you forgive me, because this comes from the deepest part of my heart, and I will continue to work and continue to do good things for good people. Thank you for listening.
Thank you for pulling yourself together. Other apologies, ladies and gentlemen. As a player, Steve Gleason is best remembered for blocking a punt in the New Orleans Saints' return a year after the flood, a blocked punt that spurred his team to a victory over the Falcons. But for courageously continuing to live his life while Lou Gehrig's disease ravaged his body, Gleason has become universally respected by everyone who knows his story, except perhaps people at Atlanta sports radio station 790 The Zone, where he was subject of a Monday morning segment that made fun of his disability. Many listeners were angered. The Zone confirmed it received strong negative feedback after airing the bit. The guys at The Zone apparently thought it would be funny to engage in a mock interview in which they poked fun of Gleason and used a robotic voice to portray things Gleason might say if he were still able to speak. The mayhem in the AM show that ran the segment acknowledged that he had made, the host, Nick Cellini, acknowledged he'd made a serious error in judgment. My apologies to everyone. It was a stupid attempt at humor that backfired. Emphasis on stupid, he wrote. An undercover police officer posing for years as an environmental activist wrote a libelous leaflet that was highly critical of McDonald's and which led to the longest civil trial in English history. costing the fast food chain millions of dollars in legal fees. The true identity of one of the authors of the McLibel leaflet is Bob Lambert, a police officer who used the alias Bob Robinson in his 5 years infiltrating London Greenpeace. Lambert declined to comment about his role in the production of the leaflet. However, he previously offered a general apology for deceiving law-abiding members of Greenpeace, which he said was a peaceful group. Maine Governor Paul LePage is apologizing for comments aimed at a state senator, but he's not apologizing to the senator. LePage said he, by the way, had once told the Portland branch of the NAACP to, quote, kiss my butt. He made remarks to journalists targeted at State Senator Troy Jackson, a Democratic leader. LePage said Jackson claims to be for the people, but he's the first one to give it to the people without providing Vaseline, unquote. LePage now says he's sorry if anybody was offended by the sexually vulgar phrase. And he's sorry he lumped in Maine loggers with critical comments he made about Jackson himself, a logger. He had said people like Jackson ought to go back in the woods and cut trees and let somebody with a brain come down here and do some work. He did not apologize to Jackson. Oh, by the way, the Food Network has dropped celebrity chef Paula Deen after she was sued for racial discrimination. Oakland A's owner Lou Wolf apologized to the Seattle Mariners and complained to Major League Baseball about Coliseum conditions at Oakland Coliseum. The apology and complaints came a day after a raw sewage leak forced the A's and visiting Seattle Mariners to shower together in the Oakland Raiders clubhouse inside the Coliseum. A blocked pipe led to raw sewage backing up into the showers and the bathrooms. Damaged areas included both managers' offices, the umpire's room, and the Mariners' training room. David Rinetti, the A's vice president of stadium operations, told the San Francisco Chronicle such problems are not uncommon at the Coliseum, which was built way back in 1966. Amid calls for her resignation, amid growing outrage in Fukui Prefecture, the ruling party's policy chief in Japan apologized for saying the Fukui nuclear disaster has not directly caused any deaths. There were deaths among those who evacuated as a result of the disaster. Dateline St. Louis, a St. Louis bar owner, has apologized after an inappropriate remark was printed on a customer's receipt. On Father's Day afternoon, Joseph Gibson called and asked if it was okay to bring his child in for a meal. This is Friendly's Sports Bar and Grill. The bar typically does not allow anyone under the age of 21, but the manager said since it was Father's Day, he would allow it. During the meal, Gibson asked for an extra chicken leg for his son. When he got his receipt, he noticed F blank 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 needy kids, unquote. The server told Gibson it had been a joke, a comment meant only for the kitchen. The manager of the restaurant has apologized for the remark and says it should not have happened. At Friendly's, Lil Wayne has apologized for stepping on the American flag while shooting his latest video in Louisiana over the weekend. It's the Lil Wayne apology of the week. And Dan Harmon, the showrunner, creator of Community, who left in season 4, was rehired for season 5, and then in his podcast made some critical remarks about the people who took over in his absence, has now apologized and said he's apologized to anyone I hurt by using the word rape in a comedic context. Yes. And he said, obviously, the solution is to stop talking about my job and my podcast. But more importantly, I am sorry, unquote Dan Harmon. Dateline Nashville, Tennessee, Exodus International has apologized to gay people for causing them years of suffering. A total about face from the nonprofit's original position, according to its executive vice president. Randy Thomas said Exodus, the world's oldest and largest ministry aimed at converting gay Christians, still believes homosexuality is sinful, but no worse than any other sin. Tesla is recalling more than 1,000 Model S electric sedans. And Tesla founder Elon Musk, who announced the recall himself, apologized for the inconvenience to customers. Mayors Against Illegal Guns, the pro-gun control group founded by Michael Bloomberg, has apologized for including suspected Boston Marathon bomber Tamerlan Tsarnaev on a list of gun violence victims that was read aloud at a New Hampshire event last week. And the Los Angeles Fire Chief Brian Cummings apologized for a controversial photo depicting Mexicans that he displayed on Twitter. I sincerely apologize for any insensitivity or disrespect, he said. The picture, of course, showed Cummings at a department fundraiser with three men wearing fake mustaches and sombreros. U.S. Secretary of Defense Chuck Hagel has apologized after he was caught on camera asking an Indian member of an audience if he was a member of the Taliban. An Indian member of an audience at the University of Nebraska approached a microphone, prompting Hagel to make the remark. A prolonged, awkward silence followed before the man identified himself as Robin Gandhi, an assistant professor at the University of Nebraska. Through a spokesperson, Hagel immediately apologized, explaining he did not know or see who was approaching the microphone. So, ask him if they're Taliban, even if you don't know or can see them. And British Health Secretary Jeremy Hunt has apologized on behalf of the government for all the appalling suffering endured by the parents of babies that died at a hospital in England, after which the Care Quality Commission destroyed its own report into problems at those maternity units. The apologies of the week, ladies and gentlemen, a copyrighted feature of this broadcast. Well, ladies and gentlemen, that's going to conclude this week's edition of the show. You know where you'll find it next week. And it would be just like asking not just Eddie, but the President of the United States, are you kidding, if you agreed to join with me then. Would you already? Thank you very much. A tip of the show, chapeau to the San Diego, Chicago, in exile, Pittsburgh, and Hawaii desks. Thanks, as always, to Pam Halstead. The email address for this broadcast, a playlist of the music heard here on at a fabulous store, available at harryshearer.com. And you'll find me on Twitter, at The Harry Shearer. The show comes to you from Century of Progress Productions and originates over the facilities of the Change is Hard Radio Network.